Good day. My name is Tim here at the Talking Information Center. I'll be reading from the front page of the New York Times for Tuesday, February 17th. Despite Epstein's toxicity, Steve Bannon stood by him, texts indicate. Mr. Bannon, a MAGA podcaster, developed a seemingly chummy relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, who was accused of sex trafficking. He said it was in the name of getting Mr. Epstein to open up. By Sharon Lafreniere and Teresa Mandria-Terol. Mid-afternoon in late June of 2019, Stephen K. Bannon sent Jeffrey Epstein an excited series of texts. "Dude," 4 exclamation points, he wrote, "is this real? Tell me this is real." Mr. Epstein had just texted him a headline from the Miami Herald. It reported that victims of Mr. Epstein's sexual abuse had lost a court battle to nullify a decade-old agreement that protected him from prosecution for those crimes. Off and on for months, Mr. Bannon, a leader in the MAGA movement and a former top aide to President Trump, had been advising Mr. Epstein on how to handle resurrected allegations that he was a serial pedophile. Mr. Bannon recommended which lawyers to hire, his own, when to lie low, and when he should jump on an opening to push his narrative. He scheduled what the two men called media training. "First, we need to push back on the lies, then crush the pedo trafficking narrative, then rebuild your image as philanthropist," Mr. Bannon wrote to Mr. Epstein in April of 2019. That was 5 months after a Miami Herald series exposed how prosecutors had ignored evidence of Mr. Epstein's crimes. The 3 million pages of Epstein-related documents released by the Justice Department on January 30th reveal for the first time the extent of Mr. Bannon's efforts to advise Mr. Epstein when many of his friends were abandoning him. In the 6 months before Mr. Epstein was arrested and charged with the sex trafficking of minors in July of 2019, Mr. Bannon's name appeared nearly every day in the files, often because the two men exchanged texts. In a statement to the New York Times, Mr. Bannon said his relationship with Mr. Epstein was strictly professional. "I am a filmmaker and TV host with decades of experience interviewing controversial figures," he said. "That's the only lens through which these private communications should be viewed. A documentary filmmaker working over a period of time to secure 60 hours of interviews from a reclusive subject." He said the film would fully expose Mr. Epstein and destroy the very myths he created. A spokesman said Mr. Bannon planned to release the film, now 6 years in the making, later this year. Mr. Bannon is one of the biggest political names to be caught up in the latest chapter of the Epstein scandal. Mr. Bannon is a headline speaker at major Republican political events and hosts one of the nation's top political podcasts. Like many other prominent members of the MAGA movement, he had called for the release of the files pertaining to Mr. Epstein. A torrent of texts and email exchanges show that after Mr. Bannon and Mr. Epstein met in late 2017, Mr. Bannon promised to help Mr. Epstein rehabilitate his reputation. As Mr. Epstein's legal troubles mounted in 2019, Mr. Bannon helped strategize a defense, the documents indicate. He told Mr. Epstein several months before his arrest, "We must counter rapist who traffics in female children to be raped by world's most powerful, richest man. That can't be redeemed." A spokesman for Mr. Bannon said his client sought only to ingratiate himself with Mr. Epstein for the documentary. But written communications during the year and a half before Mr. Epstein's death in custody in August of 2019 suggest that far from wary, Mr. Epstein was eager to cater to Mr. Bannon's wishes and needs. He shipped Mr. Bannon and his son Apple Watches. He offered Mr. Bannon his private jet to fly around Europe, joking, "How does it feel to have the most highly paid travel agent in history?" He proposed that Mr. Bannon get a full medical workup in Mr. Epstein's private area at a high-end concierge emergency clinic, telling him that your medical expenses from A to Z have been covered by me. Mr. Bannon's spokesman said he never saw Mr. Epstein's doctor, nor did he fly on his private jet. As Mr. Bannon promoted himself as a strategist to populist and nationalist political parties abroad, Mr. Epstein tried to help him build connections. "Whatever you need, I'm in," he wrote to Mr. Bannon in mid-2018. A host of prominent figures in the U.S. and abroad have been tarnished and toppled by the documentation of their contacts with Mr. Epstein in the newly released files. Most recently, Catherine Rumler, a former top Obama administration lawyer, resigned from Goldman Sachs after emails revealed a lengthy friendship with Mr. Epstein. Mr. Bannon, 72, faced a string of legal troubles in recent years. The court cases partly explain why the documentary has yet to be released, his spokesman said. He served 4 months in prison in 2024 for contempt of Congress after refusing to testify before the committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Mr. Trump's Justice Department is now seeking to wipe out that conviction. An effort to fund Mr. Trump's wall on the border with Mexico led to charges that Mr. Bannon had pocketed hundreds of thousands of dollars in funds from contributors. A state court sentenced him to 3 years probation on a fraud charge in February of 2025. But Mr. Bannon escaped a trial on related federal charges when Mr. Trump pardoned him just before leaving office in January of 2021. Federal agents had arrested Mr. Bannon the previous year while he was on a yacht owned by a Chinese billionaire, Guo Wengui, who was later convicted in a separate $1 billion fraud scheme. Mr. Bannon was named as a co-conspirator in that case, but was not charged. "Someone has to fund his nonsenses," Mr. Epstein emailed an associate who asked why Mr. Bannon had allied himself with Mr. Gu. Mr. Bannon has continued to be a featured speaker at the influential Conservative Political Action Conference and at Turning Point USA, the conservative organization founded by Charlie Kirk. At a Turning Point event last July, he shouted to a crowd, "It's deeper than Epstein." Mr. Epstein first tried to meet with Mr. Bannon in November of 2016, after Mr. Trump won the presidency, the documents suggest. But Mr. Bannon, a top campaign strategist for Mr. Trump and later a senior White House official, agreed only after the president had fired him in August of 2017. The two men quickly seemed to bond over finance, science, politics, and the ongoing drama of the Trump White House. "We have become friends," Mr. Epstein wrote to an associate about Mr. Bannon in February of 2018. But by then, Mr. Bannon was seeking to advise right-wing foreign politicians, mostly in Europe. Mr. Epstein introduced him to political figures he knew. The pair do not appear to have discussed the irony of a famous billionaire who kept a black book of his connections with the global elite, helping Mr. Bannon whip up anti-elitist political sentiment. Mr. Bannon met Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, through Mr. Epstein. When Mr. Barak formed a new political party in Israel in June of 2019, Mr. Bannon wrote to Mr. Epstein, "Can we announce I'm his strategic advisor?" A spokesman for Mr. Barak said he had never hired Mr. Bannon. On Saturday, Mr. Barak apologized for his friendship with Mr. Epstein. Mr. Epstein's itinerary show more than a dozen breakfasts, lunches, and dinners with Mr. Bannon at Mr. Epstein's seven-story Manhattan townhouse. The texts reveal a level of seeming chumminess, with the two men exchanging political gossip and jokes about each other. Mr. Epstein repeatedly urged Mr. Bannon to care for himself, texting, Lucifer with a stroke, bent horns and all, doesn't look so good. Mr. Bannon's spokesman, said that in addition to not taking up Mr. Epstein's offer to hitch a ride on his plane, he never stayed overnight at any of Mr. Epstein's residences. Yet some documents suggest that Mr. Bannon was willing to entertain such perks. At the end of March of 2019, Mr. Epstein was staying at his luxurious apartment near the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. He had told his pilot that Mr. Bannon would be flying back to New York with him on April 2nd. Mr. Bannon texted him on March 29 from Rome, "Is it possible to get your plane here to collect me?" Mr. Epstein replied that the plane was unavailable but offered to pay for a charter flight. 2 days later, Mr. Bannon wrote that he was flying to Paris that evening and asked, "I'm staying with you tonight?" "Yes, stay," Mr. Epstein replied. En route, Mr. Bannon texted a few hours later. The next morning, Mr. Epstein wrote to an associate that Steve Bannon is here with me. Mr. Bannon's spokesman said Mr. Bannon decided to stay in a hotel that he had already booked, but said Mr. Bannon declined to provide a receipt to the Times. Mr. Bannon's spokesman said he conducted about 12 hours of interviews with Mr. Epstein for the documentary, but for reasons that remain unclear, the newly released files contain only 2 hours of interviews. In those segments, shot in Mr. Epstein's Grand Library in New York, Mr. Bannon asked Mr. Epstein whether he had reflected upon how he ended up behind bars in 2008. "No," Mr. Epstein replied, "I would just say how strange that this happens." Mr. Bannon did not ask Mr. Epstein directly about his treatment of women, although Mr. Epstein acknowledged to him that he had been classified as a sexual predator. His spokesman said Mr. Bannon did not get deeper into that topic in 12 hours of interviews, but planned to address it later. To Mr. Epstein, Mr. Bannon said that while others called him irredeemable, "You are a lot of things, which we will show, but you are not that." Mr. Epstein was worried that he came across as too glib in the footage, like Prince of Darkness meets the Joker, he wrote in one message. But Mr. Bannon reassured him, saying that his film crew had been mesmerized because they had been expecting a monster. After news broke in early February 2019 that federal prosecutors were reviewing the handling of Mr. Epstein's 2008 criminal case, the messages between the two men took on a new urgency. Mr. Epstein asked whether he should respond to the reports. "Have you lost your mind?" Mr. Bannon texted, using an expletive. "The moment you say anything, this is global story." In following weeks, Mr. Epstein peppered Mr. Bannon with questions. Should his lawyers grant the press an anonymous interview? Should he invite a reporter to the New Yorker? For the New Yorker to his house. At one point, Mr. Epstein forwarded a transcript with an unnamed victim, Jane Doe One, suggesting it supported his defense. Mr. Bannon offered his own suggestions. Did you hire the crisis comms guy so we can drive the narrative off that great Times piece?" he asked in March of 2019. That was an apparent reference to a letter from Mr. Epstein's lawyers published in the Times the previous day that contended that allegations against Mr. Epstein were greatly exaggerated. He recommended that Mr. Epstein hire William A. Burke and Alex Spiro, who had represented Mr. Bannon during the special counsel investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. He referred to them as "my boys." Mr. Bannon notified Mr. Epstein of a meeting with Mr. Spiro in April of 2019, but at the last minute, Mr. Bannon texted, "Spiro out, firm killed it just now." In a statement to Mr. Spiro, "Several people asked me to represent or at least speak with Mr. Epstein. I categorically refused to do either," Mr. Burke said. He had no contact with Mr. Epstein. That same week, Mr. Bannon texted Mr. Epstein, "Friday afternoon media training at your place. Two camera shoots. My crew are so totally confidential." Mr. Epstein replied that the three-hour session would be trial by fire. Mr. Bannon's spokesman said it was solely for the documentary. Later, Mr. Epstein wanted a legal agreement known as a COVIL, apparently designed to extend attorney-client privilege to his communications with Mr. Bannon, who was not a lawyer. Mr. Bannon wrote back, "We need a deal for the entire training." Mr. Bannon's spokesman said Mr. Bannon never signed the agreement and voluntarily shared his footage with federal prosecutors after Mr. Epstein's death in a jail cell ruled to be a suicide. Mr. Bannon wrote in their correspondence that he believed that Mr. Epstein was under constant surveillance, and both men tried to ensure that Mr. Bannon would not be left lingering on the doorstep when he visited Mr. Epstein in Manhattan. Mr. Bannon alerted Mr. Epstein when a servant should be ready to open the door for him. At one point, Mr. Epstein wrote that he would understand if Mr. Bannon declined a dinner invitation. "I fully understand my toxicity for the moment," he said, but the two men continued to schedule meetings up until Mr. Epstein's arrest. They had planned to meet on the first weekend of July 2019 after Mr. Epstein flew home from Paris. But he was apprehended that Saturday when his plane landed at a New Jersey airport. "All canceled," he texted. It was his last message to Mr. Bannon. With latest rollback, the U.S. essentially has no clean car rules. The EPA's killing of the endangerment finding caps a year of deregulation that is likely to make cars thirstier for gas and less competitive globally, experts say. By Hiroko Tabuchi. The momentous end to the federal government's legal authority to fight climate change makes it official. The United States will essentially have no laws on the books that enforce how efficient America's passenger cars and trucks should be. That's the practical result of the Trump administration's year-long parade of regulatory rollbacks, capped on Thursday by its killing of the endangerment finding, the scientific determination that required the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate greenhouse gases because of the threat to human health. "The U.S. no longer has emission standards of any meaning," said Margot T. Ogue, who served as the EPA's top vehicle emissions regulator under three presidents and has since advised both automakers and environmental groups. "Nothing, zero," she added. "Not many countries have zero." Transportation is the largest single source of greenhouse gases in the United States. Car buyers could still vote with their wallets, demanding more fuel-efficient cars. California has vowed to sue to maintain stricter standards. The Department of Transportation still regulates fuel economy under rules meant to conserve oil. And the EPA still regulates other tailpipe emissions like nitrogen oxides that harm human health. But last year, the Trump administration proposed weakening the fuel economy standards to largely irrelevant levels. The Republican-controlled Congress also set civil penalties for violations at $0, essentially making them voluntary for automakers. In addition, Congress last year blocked California's clean car rules. The bottom line is that the United States is set to stand apart from a majority of the world's industrialized nations which have mandatory fuel economy or greenhouse gas tailpipe emissions rules. The Biden administration had sought to tighten limits on emissions to encourage automakers to sell more non-polluting electric vehicles. The Trump administration's elimination of the endangerment finding on Thursday is expected to face fierce legal challenges from environmental groups and others. The endangerment finding was a 2009 scientific conclusion that greenhouse gas emissions pose a danger to Americans' health and welfare. It provided the foundation to justify federal regulations that limit carbon dioxide, methane, and other pollution, including from cars. If the EPA's decision holds, it could increase the country's greenhouse gas emissions by 10% over the next 30 years, according to the Environmental Defense Fund, an advocacy group. Greenhouse emissions are the main driver of global climate change, which in turn is intensifying heat waves, drought, hurricanes, and floods, while also melting glaciers, causing sea levels to rise. Lee Zeldin, the EPA administrator, called the end of the finding the single largest deregulatory action in the history of the United States. He accused Democrats of having launched an ideological crusade on climate change that had strangled entire sectors of the United States economy, particularly the auto industry, which he has struggled to sell electric vehicles. Climate concerns aside, it's unclear whether the U.S. auto industry will ultimately benefit from the elimination of emissions and fuel efficiency regulations. The move could leave American automakers even more dominated by gas-guzzling trucks and sport utility vehicles, experts said, as China and other nations continue to shift toward cleaner electric cars. That could leave them at a competitive disadvantage in coming years. Our automakers are not going to survive, Ms. Ogg predicted. John Bozzella, the president of the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, which represents automakers in the United States, has declined to say whether he supports the end of the endangerment finding. But he said in a statement that the move would correct some of the unachievable emissions regulations enacted under the previous administration. Mr. Trump has swung back and forth on his opinion of electric vehicles. During the 2024 presidential campaign, he said electric cars would kill America's auto industry. But he appeared to at least temporarily soften his stance at the urging of Elon Musk, the chief executive of Tesla and his one-time close advisor. In March, he said he would buy a Tesla. Globally, the push is in exactly the opposite direction, in the direction of electrifying vehicles, said Ann Carlson, a professor at UCLA School of Law who served under President Joe Biden as acting administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the Transportation Department agency that sets fuel efficiency standards. But now they're saying no standards whatsoever, she said. For 17 years, the EPA worked in tandem with the Department of Transportation, with the EPA, regulating carbon dioxide emissions to protect health, and the Transportation Department governing how much fuel a car can burn to conserve fuel. The endangerment finding had allowed the EPA in recent years to push standards more aggressively than possible using fuel economy rules alone, setting targets so low they would eventually have become virtually impossible for gasoline engines to meet. The EPA also had the authority, for example, to issue stop sale orders if an automaker failed to meet standards, preventing them from selling certain cars until the issue was resolved. The first Trump administration had moved to weaken both the tailpipe emissions and fuel economy standards. Mr. Biden had then reversed course, strengthening them. But now that the second Trump administration has eliminated the EPA's underlying authority to regulate greenhouse gases, another reversal by a future administration could be more difficult. Even if a new administration came in and was inclined to regulate greenhouse gases, it would take years to reissue and defend the endangerment finding, Professor Carlson said. And in the meantime, they would have no authority to write any new greenhouse gas regulations. The remaining rules, such as the fuel efficiency requirements, could also be weakened. In December, the Trump administration proposed resetting the Transportation Department standard to require automakers to achieve an average of 34.5 miles per gallon for the full lineup of cars they sell by 2031. The Biden-era target was closer to 50 miles per gallon. These new standards would be less stringent than those in the European Union, as well as those of countries like China, Japan, and India. Congress's separate decision to eliminate fines for failure to comply with efficiency standards also makes the rules voluntary, saying automakers' significant compliance costs. Any resulting shift by American automakers towards gas guzzlers that can't be sold in Europe or China could further isolate the U.S. market, and the U.S. would increasingly cede the future of automotive technology to Chinese electric vehicle giants like BYD, experts said. We're an outlier now, said Joshua Lin, a professor at the University of Maryland who studies environmental policies and the transportation sector. Those larger trucks and SUVs tend to make them more money, he said. But if they want to compete in Europe or East Asia, they really need to be able to produce those EVs. A divergence in tailpipe emissions rules could emerge domestically. California has promised a court challenge, saying the state would fight to continue to regulate greenhouse gases. Other states are expected to follow California's lead. To have a patchwork of systems makes it really hard for companies that do business in 50 states, let alone in other countries, said Ann Kelly, the president of Government Relations at Ceres, an advocacy group that works with businesses on their sustainability plans. There is no world in which this is helpful for the auto industry. Matthew Beecham, a senior research analyst at S&P Global Mobility, an automotive company, said that given the uncertainties, automakers were likely to hedge their bets. They might expand their gasoline car lineups, he said, but most likely would not abandon electrification completely. And despite no penalties for violating the remaining fuel economy standards, there was unlikely to be wholesale lawbreaking, he said, because state rules and investor scrutiny could keep companies in check. Expect tactical shifts towards profitable trucks and not open defiance, he added. Still, a shift toward larger gasoline models could ultimately undermine their competitiveness in an intensifying global EV race. Car makers around the world are scrambling to secure enough EV batteries, for example, and that race penalizes laggards, he said. While the EPA continues to regulate pollutants like nitrogen oxides that pose direct threats to human health, it is now also seeking to weaken those rules. Aaron Szabo, the EPA's air quality chief, wrote in an opinion article published by The Hill in December that rolling back those rules would reduce red tape and bring common sense back to rulemaking. The move to roll back regulation increases increases choice and lowers the price of cars, he said. But vehicles that burn more fuel cost car owners more at the pump, said Daniel Becker, the director of the Safe Climate Transport Campaign at the Center for Biological Diversity and Environmental Group. In addition to the cost to the climate, public health, and industrial competitiveness. The Trump administration is telling American manufacturers, you guys go build gasoline cars again, he said. The Chinese government is telling its manufacturers, you go build the advanced vehicles that are going to take over the world. Three American speeches at Munich and plenty of confusion. As the U.S. message veered from shared heritage and values to shared interests and back again, Europeans wondered what kind of alliance they were left with. By Stephen Erlanger and David Sanger. In the space of just a year, European leaders have heard three descriptions of how the Trump administration is reimagining the American relationship with its allies. Each strikes a bit of a different tone, but all are intended to push them into a new era in which Washington's commitment to defend them faces new limits. One was delivered by Vice President J.D. Vance last year, a blistering condemnation of European-style democracy, arguing that waves of immigrants and Europe's restrictions on its own far-right parties pose a greater threat to the continent than Russia's aggression. The second was a far easier to swallow version of a similar message from Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Saturday. He described a hazy and sometimes idealized cultural history shared by Europe and the United States and argued that each faced civilizational erasure unless it figured out a way to control its borders. Then at the same conference, the most senior defense official to attend, Elbridge Colby, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, offered a classic American national security message about shared interests, not values, recommending that both sides focus on nuts and bolts kinds of stuff. If the Europeans emerged a bit confused, it's understandable. Mr. Vance and Mr. Rubio could well end up as rivals for the presidential nomination in 2028 or as running mates. So how they described America's role and purpose with its allies was intended as much for audiences at home. They know each phrase will be weighed by MAGA supporters who are suspicious of the degree to which the Trump administration has intervened around the world, whether in Venezuela or Iran, Syria or Greenland. But their immediate audiences were NATO allies. While the Europeans have committed to spending far more on their defenses between now and 2035, they also know should the breach with the United States widen, they would need to replicate America's vast powers and reach, a project that would cost them far more and could take 10 to 20 years. Mr. Vance's speech last year was met by a stunned silence, even gasps. Mr. Rubio's softer version on Saturday morning drew a standing applause, but those in the hall of the Bayershire Hof Hotel, a stately remnant of the old Europe that Mr. Rubio seemed to be idealizing, his words were deemed reassuring by the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. The chairman of the Security Conference, Wolfgang Ischinger, noted that while Mr. Vance talked about NATO as them, Mr. Rubin referred to the alliance as we. Still, he said that Mr. Rubio's speech was a starkly American view of the world. For many European officials and analysts, the reaction quickly turned cautious. Mr. Rubio's case for the alliance barely touched on the threats from Russia and other adversaries, and was far more of a defense of the White House Christian heritage that he said connects Europe and the United States. While Mr. Rubio did not mention the far-right parties that Mr. Vance praised, he seemed to give voice to the argument that the purpose of national security strategy was to protect our civilization, Western civilization. We are bound to one another by the deepest bonds that nations could share, he said, forged by centuries of shared history, Christian faith, culture, heritage, language, ancestry, and the sacrifices our forefathers made together for the common civilization to which we have fallen heir. He argued that the Trump administration has no interest in being polite and orderly caretakers of the West's managed decline, adding, "We do not seek to separate, but to revitalize an old friendship and renew the greatest civilization in human history." And it was noticed by everyone that Mr. Rubio chose to travel from Munich to Slovakia and Hungary, countries run by populist far-right parties that are skeptical of the European Union and that have moved closer to Russia, especially on the war in Ukraine. Lunk van Middelaar, a Dutch historian and former EU official, called the Rubin speech well-crafted and therefore all the more dangerous for the Europeans, offering a new pact on the basis of a shared civilization, but omitting the Vance part of a year ago, which comes with U.S. alignment with MAGA allies in Europe. So in a sense, he argued, the Europeans are walking into a trap. Mr. Rubio tried to embrace us in a shared story of history and peoples, kin, and religion, while leaving out an awful lot of non-white Europeans and Americans, too. A senior European official described Mr. Rubio's argument as a poison pill. His case for defending Western civilization, he said, was offered as a bargain for America's defensive umbrella, with its implicit suggestion that the U.S. and its Western allies were fighting to preserve a whiter, more Christian Europe It would make it far harder, he argued, for European leaders to interact with the rest of the world, let alone with their own non-Christian citizens. While some Europeans understand that Mr. Vance and Mr. Rubio are speaking to two audiences, one in Europe, one in the United States, Mr. Colby is not a politician. He is a conservative defense scholar who finds himself cast in the role of explaining a Trump national security strategy that is shifting each week. He spoke of common sense and flexible realism, dismissing talk of shared values as hosannas or shibboleths. From our part of the political spectrum, I'm not sure that's true, he said. Instead, let's ground our partnership on something more enduring and durable and kind of real, like shared interests, Mr. Colby said. The values are obviously there, and the history is there, he said. But you can't base an alliance on sentiment alone, and maybe there are differences of values. The message went over far better with Europeans like Chancellor Friedrich Merz of Germany, who in his opening remarks to the conference said pointedly, "The culture wars of the MAGA movement are not ours." Mr. Colby's view of a relationship of shared interests is far closer to where the Europeans want to be, with his open commitment to collective defense and the American nuclear guarantee. Mr. Colby insisted that over time Europe would have to defend itself in any conventional war, noting that America's presence at the core of NATO's is integral to ensure that conventional conflict does not escalate to a nuclear one. After all was said, Europe was left wondering which America it is allying with, said Ivan Krastev, a Bulgarian political scientist who is a fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences, a research institution in Vienna. Sometimes we say we can do without the Americans, and then sometimes we're relieved that America seems to be back, he said. Europeans who see in Mr. Rubio a return to the kind of American ally they have known since the end of World War II are fooling themselves, he said. And you could say Europeans want to be fooled since they are dependent on the U.S. even more today than in 1989, the year that the Berlin Wall was breached, given Russia's four-year war on Ukraine, which directly challenges European security. Europeans are less worried about the pressure to spend more on the military as the United States turns to China, Mr. Krastev said. What Europeans are most worried about is that this administration became highly ideological, he said. What is new is the readiness of the U.S. to enter European domestic politics. And what's interesting is not what Rubio said here, but where he goes from here to Slovakia and Hungary. The immigration debate came to rural Kansas. Locals stood by their mayor. By Mitch Smith. A standing room only crowd jammed recently into the only courtroom in Comanche County, Kansas. Residents came on their lunch breaks, trekked in from their ranches, and even closed down a hardware store so they could watch. They were there for the man of the at the defendant's table, Joe Caballos, who just weeks before had been reelected mayor of Coldwater in a small town landslide, with 101 votes to his opponent's 20. There had been no time to celebrate. Hours before the votes were tallied, Mr. Caballos, a legal permanent resident of the United States, was charged in state court with voting illegally as a non-citizen. Now, Mr. Caballos, 55, sat in the high-ceiling courtroom, glancing downward as a prosecutor from the Kansas Attorney General's office rattled off a list of felony charges that could lead to years in prison. 3 counts of elections perjury, 3 counts of voting without being qualified. When the charges were announced a few weeks before the hearing, the municipal politics of Coldwater suddenly became national news. Many conservatives from outside Comanche County framed the case as an example of rampant voter fraud. Before the first court hearing in December, the Trump administration drew attention to the case, pledging to seek Mr. Caballos' deportation if he were convicted. this alien committed a felony by voting in American elections. Trisha McLaughlin, a spokesman for the Department of Homeland Security, said in a news release that included a photo of Mr. Ceballos and his signature on a voter registration form. Yet inside Coldwater, home to 700 people, zero stoplights, and vanishingly few Democrats, the prosecution was widely seen as a personal attack on a pillar of the town. Most of them, Mr. Ceballos included, had voted for President Trump, and some said they supported his immigration policies. But they knew Joe, a fixture in Coldwater since he was a teenager, and they wanted the government to back off. Decades before he appeared at the county courthouse as a defendant, Mr. Ceballos said he went to that same limestone-trimmed building in New York Avenue on a high school field trip. His teacher, Gail Boisseau, said she showed a group of students, those were seniors, around taking them to the spot where they would pay their taxes and introducing them to courthouse employees. When they got to the county clerk's office, she and Mr. Ceballos each recalled, the person working there asked if students who were at least 18 would like to register to vote. Mr. Ceballos said he filled out the form. Federal and state laws require that voters be United States citizens, and Kansas must check a box saying that they are citizens when they register to vote. Nobody ever told me I couldn't vote or register to vote, Mr. Ceballos said during a recent interview inside the city council chamber, where he once presided over meetings. And so as a young man, yeah, I did it. I registered. The county clerk, Briul, said her office had no record of Mr. Ceballos registering to vote before 1999, when he would have been in his late 20s. Mr. Ceballos' lawyer, Jess Holm, said in an email that Joe is confident he was registered and had voted prior to the renewal of or re-registration in 1999, but I'm having a hard time proving it. Mr. Ceballos was born in Mexico and came to the U.S. when he was 4 years old. He and his lawyer said he moved around as a child before ending up in Coldwater, just north of the Oklahoma border in west central Kansas, as a teenager in the 1980s. For all but a few months since then, Comanche County has been home. Mr. Ceballos, who received a green card in 1990, said he had never been back to Mexico, and though he used to help local law enforcement as an informal Spanish interpreter, he said his knowledge of the language had faded. Mr. Ceballos wears cowboy boots, drives a Ram truck, and speaks with a slight Southern Plains accent. He cheers for the Dallas Cowboys, rides a Harley-Davidson, and has a cavernous workshop next to his house that is stuffed with tools, car parts, and an old Pepsi machine. He said he did not follow national politics closely, but agreed with much of what the president had said about energy policy and illegal immigration. Mr. Ceballos said he voted for Mr. Trump in the last three presidential elections. I still strongly believe in Trump's immigration laws about let's get the bad guys out of here, you know. They're murderers. They killed people. They molested people. Let's get them out of here, Mr. Ceballos said in an interview. But I feel like I don't fit that category, and I feel like that's how they're treating me. Over time, Mr. Ceballos became part of the fabric of Coldwater, a place where most people seem to have known most everybody else since childhood. He married twice, raised children, and bought a pasture just outside city limits where he tends to a herd of cattle. Each year, he hosts a mud run for large trucks, drawing spectators from across the region. Court records show that Mr. Ceballos was arrested in 1994 and convicted of misdemeanor battery for his role in a fight involving several people. Someone was shot and wounded during that fight. According to those records, though, Mr. Ceballos was not accused of shooting anyone. He and his lawyer described that case as well as a 1995 case that led to a conviction for a misdemeanor criminal damage to property as related to the end of Mr. Cavallo's first marriage. Kansas court records available online do not show any arrests of Mr. Cavallo's in the last 30 years. As he made a life in Coldwater, where 90% of the residents are white, Mr. Cavallo's became a regular voter, always choosing Republicans. He worked for years in Coldwater's Public Works Department, then landed a job as a lineman with a utility company where he is still employed. His neighbors elected him as a city council member, then as mayor, a position in which he focused on keeping up basic services while managing a tight budget. He said the job paid $500 a month. One of his signature issues, he said, was maintaining the pavement on Coldwater's aging streets rather than converting them to dirt roads. He resigned as mayor soon after the charges were announced. His work in city government earned good reviews. Britt Linnertz, who took over as mayor for a few weeks after Mr. Cavallo's resigned, said that whenever it came to anything that he could do to try to improve the community, he wanted to be a part of it. He was known for checking in with the city clerk almost every day to see if anything needed his attention. For Christmas, he arranged to cut down a cedar tree at the nearby lake and install it in the middle of Coldwater's ultra-wide main street. And when Rick Beeley posted a few years ago in the local newspaper that he was hoping to retire from his role decorating Main Street and U.S. flags for patriotic holidays, Mr. Cavallo's was the only person who responded and volunteered to take on that job, he said. I'm a Vietnam vet. He's just as American as I am, Mr. Beeley said. A day before his court appearance, an advertisement in the Western Star, Coldwater's newspaper, urged readers to attend the hearing. Please find the time to show support for Joe Cavallo's. Over many years, Joe chose this community to be his forever home and gave of his time and energy, the advertisements added. Even Mr. Cavallo's opponent in November's nonpartisan mayoral election, Greg Vander Ree, had nothing particularly bad to say about him. Mr. Vander Ree, a Republican who said he broadly supported Mr. Trump's policies on immigration, said he had no idea before the charges were announced that Mr. Cavallo's was not a citizen. Mr. Vander Ree said he played no role in reporting his opponent to the authorities and said he had been hurt that some of his neighbors seemed to think he had. As far as what should happen to Mr. Cavallo now, he said, there were no easy answers. He's not a bad guy, Mr. Vander Ree said. He's not doing anything to harm anybody, but he did. I mean, he flat broke the law. And the trouble is, due to other things, he's been made an example of. In the Kansas Attorney General, to the Kansas City General, Chris Kobach, the case against Mr. Cavallo's was proof of what he had insisted for years. Non-citizen voting is a real problem, Mr. Kobach, a Republican said at the news conference where he announced the case against the mayor. It is not something that happens once in a decade. It is something that happens fairly frequently. He said that too little had been done over the years to identify ineligible voters and remove them from the rolls. Every time a non-citizen votes, it effectively cancels out the vote of a U.S. citizen, Mr. Kobach said, adding, if a person who is not a U.S. citizen actually ends up on the ballot for an office, then a U.S. citizen lost the opportunity to obtain that office. Concern about election fraud and voting by non-citizens is now a core issue for many Republicans. But Mr. Kobach was ahead of his time in identifying that topic's political potency. When he was Kansas Secretary of State in the 2010s, Mr. Kobach built a national profile by calling for stricter election laws and by prosecuting a small number of people accused of voting illegally. In fact, voter fraud is rare, and an exceedingly low percentage of ballots are cast by non-citizens in the U.S. Mr. Kobach declined, though, through a spokesman, to be interviewed. Outside Coldwater, the push to prosecute Mr. Cavallo's won the Attorney General praise from fellow conservatives. But around Comanche County, a county where Mr. Kobach and Mr. Trump have overwhelmingly won elections, some question the decision. I think he needs to find out a little bit more what's going on, Dennis Bryam said of Mr. Kobach, for whom he voted. Mr. Bryam, who closed down his hardware store to attend Mr. Sebelius' court appearance, said the whole county backs the former mayor. Ryan Swayze, a high school classmate of Mr. Sebelius, who now ranches just south of the state line in Oklahoma, said, I feel like this is an AG that's drawing attention to himself. Still, the defining challenge for Mr. Sebelius and his supporters is that he openly acknowledges doing what he is accused of doing. Yes, Mr. Sebelius said he voted repeatedly in U.S. elections without being a United States citizen, and that is illegal. His defense essentially is that he did not understand that being a permanent resident should have precluded him from voting and holding office, and that no one ever told him he was not eligible. He has said he engaged in politics not in some plot to subvert the system, but out of a desire to help the place he considers home. After decades as a permanent resident, Mr. Sebelius said he decided last year to pursue citizenship. He said he had passed the civics test and was sitting for an interview in Wichita with a federal official when he was asked whether he had ever voted. Yes, the mayor responded. It was not the answer the government was looking for. His eyes got real big, and I was like, boy, did I do something wrong, Mr. Sebelius said. According to Mr. Sebelius and his lawyers, that exchange derailed the citizenship application, alerted Kansas officials that he had voted as a non-citizen, and set off a chain of events that led to his being charged. A lingering question is what justice might look like in this case. Should Mr. Sebelius be convicted of felonies, as the Attorney General is seeking? And if he is, should he be slated for deportation, as the Trump administration has pledged in his case? Or, as so many in Coldwater have suggested, might there be some way to give him a slap on the wrist and move on? Mr. Sebelius, whose preliminary hearing is scheduled for March, said that perhaps he should be ordered to pay a fine or even spend time on probation. But he feared a felony conviction would mean being sent back to a country he had not visited in half a century, away from his family and his cows and his tidy house on the edge of town, with hay bales wrapped in red, white, and blue. Even now, before his case is decided, he said he worried that Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents might show up looking for him. You wake up like, are they going to deport me now? He said, it's always in your thought. Robert Duvall, a chameleon of an actor on screen and on stage, dies at 95. An Oscar winner, he was known for disappearing into wide-ranging roles in movies like Apocalypse Now and The Godfather, and in the television series Lonesome Dove by Clyde Haberman. Robert Duvall, who drew from a seemingly bottomless reservoir of acting craftsmanship to transform himself into a business-focused mafia lawyer, a faded country singer, a cynical police detective, a bullying Marine pilot, a surfing-obsessed Vietnam commander, a mysterious Southern recluse, and scores of other films, stage, and television characters, died on Sunday. He was 95. His death was announced in a statement by his wife, Luciana Duval, who said he had died at home. She gave no other details. He had long lived on a sprawling horse farm in the plains in Fauquier County, Virginia, west of Washington. Mr. Duval's singular trait was to immerse himself in roles so deeply that he seemed to almost disappear into them, an ability that was uncanny, even creepy, the first time it was witnessed, said Bruce Beresford, the Australian who directed him in the 1980 film Tender Mercies. In that film, Mr. Duval played Max Sledge, a boozy, washed-up country star who comes to terms with life through marriage to a widow with a young son. The performance earned him an Academy Award for Best Actor, his sole Oscar in a career that brought him 6 other nominations in both leading and supporting roles. He is the character, Mr. Beresford said of Sledge. He's not Duvall at all. Mr. Duvall, though, wasn't buying it. What do you mean, he said, in an interview with the New York Times in 1989. I don't become the character. It's still me, doing myself altered. Audiences and reviewers remained unconvinced. For them, Mr. Duvall was a voice from far from silky and features falling more than a few degrees short of movie star handsome, effectively became someone entirely new time and time again. Across a film career that took flight in the early 1960s, he stood out for an intense studiousness that shaped his every role. Even as a boy in a Navy family that moved around the country, he had an ear for people's speech patterns and an eye for their mannerisms. I hung around a guy's memories, he once said. Insights that he gleaned were routinely tucked away in his head for potential future use. To prepare for the role of Mac Sledge, he sang with a country band and drove around East Texas with a friend, who finally had to ask what they were up to. We're looking for accents, Mr. Duvall said. On similar hunts, he hung out with assorted and sordid types. He befriended hoodlums in East Harlem while preparing for a role that would help make him a star, that of Tom Hagen, the sensible consigliere to the Corleone crime family in Francis Ford Coppola's first two Godfather movies in the early 1970s. He palled with police detectives before playing a hard-bitten investigator in True Confessions, 1981, to prepare for more of his signature stage roles as the hustler Teach in the original 1977 Broadway production of David Mamet's American Buffalo. He spent time with an ex-convict, taking from him the idea of carrying his gun over his genitals. He did similar immersions for other notable roles, whether as Lieutenant Colonel Bull Meacham, the frustrated warrior without a war, except within his own family, in The Great Santini, 1979, or Frank Hackett, the aptly named Hatchet Man executive in Network, 1976. I'm sorry, we've run out of time. You can't finish this obituary. You've been listening to the front page of the New York Times for Tuesday, February 17th. My name is Tim.